Okay. See, there's three kinds of prayer. Aside from the Lord's Prayer, which is about relationship, there's three kinds of prayer. One is, help me. Not a bad prayer. We all know that one. One is, give me. Perfectly good prayer. The serenity prayer is that. Grant me. But the other one, the third one, is use me. Use me. That's a powerful prayer because it assumes that he's already helped me. He's already given me everything I need. Now, use me. Use me. For what? For whatever. As someone through whom you can love people, great with me. As somebody that can be useful in a weekend like this, great with me. As somebody that can have fun, great with me. Use me. And when then we are in the middle of the day, we have something to do when we slam back into that other kind of intellect. We don't need to stay there. We don't even need to get there. But this, does this take some practice? Yes. Is this something that I could do before my amends were complete? No. I had to finish step 9 and go into 10, and then I could have some of this kind of peace. It's important that we do that. We'll talk about the amends probably on tomorrow night. And then he says, when we say, thy will be done, many times each day, we are in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. He said, we're in danger of excitement. Well, I kind of like excitement. I like to stir it up a little bit. Well, somewhere along the line, excitement doesn't become as interesting as being useful. There is excitement, exciting moments, but we're not stirring up excitement. And then finally, as we go through the day, we come to a point where we retire at night. And he tells us how to end the day. He says we constructively review our day, meaning that it's just a look at it. Not destructive, not like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. But just, well, look at there. Isn't that interesting? And we ask ourselves some questions. Were we resentful? As I look back over my day today, was I resentful? Yeah. I was resentful when Gary and I were in the restaurant in the airport in San Francisco. I didn't like the attitude of the hostess that seated us there. Okay. That's good. Was I selfish? I don't think so. Was I dishonest? No. As I look back on the day, no. Was I afraid? Yes. I had moments of fear that I would get up here too self-obsessed or too tired or too whatever to be effective. I was afraid about that. Okay. Do I owe an apology? No. Not today. Have I kept something to myself which should be discussed with another person at once? No. Was I kind and loving toward all? No. No. What could I have done better? I could have been kind and loving toward all. I could have smiled at that hostess. Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Yeah, pretty much most of the time, I guess I was. Was I thinking of what I could do for others, what I could pack into the stream of life? Well, I did give that some thought. Oh, I didn't get lost in it by any means. But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. This whole thing is about usefulness. We'll see it time and again this weekend. The point of the drill is to become useful. That doesn't really ring my bell much. Oh, another chance to be of service. That sounds just like servant somehow. And yet, Gary and I were talking about this. Drive down any street in your town, Los Angeles, and just from glancing at the size of the guy's house, you get some kind of an idea how useful he is in the world. Useful ain't bad. The world pays off on useful. Pays well to be useful. We were laughing about Spielberg the other day. Went by his huge place. Look how useful that guy is. I mean, really, you know, he churns a lot of money and allows a lot of people to make a lot of money. And he produces a product. And he teaches us and he inspires us and he does all of that. He's very useful, very useful. And he seems to be doing all right. You know, I mean, the guy is just doing fine. Interesting, this idea of useful. We, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness. And I don't think that it's in him to forgive us. I don't think he condemns us for that. But I'll do that. I'll say, forgive me. I'll do this before I leave my office. Usually when I leave my office at night, I'm going to a meeting. And I do it then because if I wait until fatigue sets in, I won't do this. I won't have that review. And it takes 4 minutes. But I'll do it. I have a big book in my office, and I'll just do it. I have a copy of this page and a little under the blotter. Pop it out and look at it. Because I want to go to the meeting clean. I don't want to have anything. I don't want to be worried about the fact that I told a lie to another attorney. I don't want to be worried about the fact that I used a snotty tone with my secretary, that I was abrupt with another human being. I don't want to do that. I don't want to worry about that. And so I look at it. Because I know this. I know that if I ask God's forgiveness for whatever I've done that day, I'm free to either go to bed or go to a meeting or whatever I'm going to do. But I know that the next morning when I wake up, I will know exactly what to do. Let it alone. Don't do anything. Apologize. Make a gesture. Clean it up. Whatever it is. And I get that done. And it keeps us kind of in clean shape. But it's a constructive review. For me to wallow in self-pity or upset about it just drains me of power. That's all. And the whole point of the drill in the morning, the whole point of the drill of saying direct my thinking is to tap into power. I want to go through the day with power. Now, if we do that, there is then a way to be that is really quite interesting. It even gave me some different ways of being with the Lord's Prayer that we'll say here in a minute when we break up for tonight. Our Father who art in heaven. This way on the right side of the page, in the book it says we have seen much of heaven. That's over here on the right side of the page. This is what? Hell. It's got to be hell. Scarcity, wanting to be right all the time, defensive, guilt. There is a terrible sense of hell living like that. Is God over there? I don't think so. That's the far country. The far country. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. You're holy. That's the divinity of it. That's the sacredness of it. Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. This is it. This is the kingdom here. The realm, as it says in the book, or kingdom. It's the same word. Thy will be done on earth. It's going to be done either way. As it is in heaven. It's going to happen that way. Give us this day our daily bread. Feed me from here. This is where I want to play with you. Sing and dance with you. This is where I want to play. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against. Forgive this trip over into the far country, as I forgive others. And we'll talk about that remarkable clause on Sunday morning. Lead, you won't lead me into temptation. You're not going to take me over there. I go alone when I go there. I go alone, man. That's what's so tough about it over there. And when, incidentally, the easiest way to get to heaven, take somebody with you. Take somebody with you. When we reach out for another human being, even an enemy, God reaches out for both of us. God touches both of us. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory. Right here. Forever and ever. This is how we want to be playing it. This is the significance to me of step 11. Of just saying something as simple as direct my thinking. Because I'm always going to have a mind. I'm always going to have an ego. I'm always going to have that sense. Here, I'll say it this way. Somebody told me something quite remarkable one day. They said, and for me, the problem has always been the rock in my shoe, the pebble in my shoe, has always been lust. Now we have the non-alcoholics coming into the room. The pebble in my shoe has always been lust. I'll wait till they settle down and we'll finish this up a little bit. Welcome. Good to have you here. It goes like this. He said, you have to develop real compassion for that little piece in there that's never going to get it. There's a little piece in me that belongs only to God. I'll wait till they settle down and we'll finish this up a little bit. Welcome. Good to have you here. It goes like this. He said, you have to develop real compassion for that little piece in there that's never going to get it. There's a little piece in me that belongs only to God. There's a little piece in me that belongs to you. There's a little piece in me that ain't ever going to get it. I better have some compassion for that piece in me, because when I decide I need to snuff it out, it gives it power in some weird way. When I decide that I'm going to just get rid of that lust or that greed, it just comes up. Remember before we got here, remember how we hated it? How we hated it that we were drunks, alcoholics. And then we came here. And one of the things that happened earliest for us was we heard other people that looked just fine saying, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic. And we slowly began to have some compassion for that little piece in me that is never going to be able to handle booze. That's okay, it's okay. And that's the way that it goes. There's a little piece in me that's never going to ever get it. Because I'm a human being. And what'll I do with that piece? Try to extinguish it? Try to pretend it doesn't exist? Try to pretend it's not part of the thing? No. I have to have some compassion for it. And the best way to do that, the thing that has helped me so much, is that there is always in every meeting somebody sitting there that I think is never going to get it. And he's the rogue in the meeting. He's the little point of separation. And he's the one that I'm going to go up to and say hi and give him a hug or shake his hand or let him think he's welcome there. Let him think I'm glad he's there. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. But I know that if I can have compassion for that guy, I can more easily develop compassion for that little piece of me that's never going to get it. And so this is a wonderful place to play and a wonderful place to be. And I wanted to start with step 11 tonight because we want to go here. We want to be able to play here. But before we can really play there, we have to take a look at the other steps, and we'll do that tomorrow. Now in a minute, we'll stand up here and we'll say the Lord's Prayer to close tonight's session. And as we do, let's think about which side of the road we want to be on. Let's think about direct my thinking, where God is and where he is not, and where we want to play. Tomorrow, we'll have breakfast, and then we'll start at whatever time we start, 9 o'clock. And I would like to ask you specifically to share your thoughts, to ask questions, to be a part of this, to let me know what's going on with you. And participate with me so we can come together and be together and have a really sweet weekend. All right. Shall we stand and say the Lord's Prayer? Alcoholic. All right. Saturday morning, 10th annual. Is it 10th? 10th annual Sky Camp Men's Spiritual Retreat. Last night we talked about step 11. Started at the with the idea of step 11, of going through a day in conscious contact. We talked about, we didn't really talk so much about meditation, but I've got a little information for you on meditation this morning. It comes from Southern California. Picture yourself near a stream. Birds are singing in the crisp, cool mountain air. Nothing can bother you here. No one knows this secret place. You are in total seclusion from that place called the world. The soothing sound of a gentle waterfall fills the air with a cascade of serenity. The water is clear. You can easily make out the face of the person whose head you're holding under the water. There now, feeling better? Any questions? Well, any comments or questions from last night? Anything you want to comment on for the weekend? Anybody got a bit of input they'd like to give us? Let's start at step one then this morning. Step one is an admission, of course, of powerlessness, of unmanageability, and it's a little bit difficult to grasp that notion of powerlessness. Except when we come to alcohol, and we all know that we're powerless over alcohol. But it takes a little bit of doing, and I think some living in sobriety, before we really understand that we're powerless, period. The book says, there is one who has all power, and that one is God. If he's got all power, I'm wondering if there's any for me. I mean, it's like, basically, I think I'm in the, I picture myself now, and this took, as you can imagine, a lot of thumping, me getting thumped. But today I see myself in a raft in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I see myself in that raft with an oar. And I'm trying real hard to get some place, to move out of where I am. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I don't like it where I am. And I grab that oar and I just go at it. And what I do is I bring that raft around in tight little circles. But the oar and my energy of moving that around in tight little circles gives me the illusion that I have some power. But I'm not going anywhere. And it isn't until I'm willing to notice that I'm not going anywhere, willing to notice that I'm circling the drain and have been for a long time, willing to notice that this is not all of my scheming and planning and efforts aren't putting me where I want to, they will not take me where I want to go. And I have to get there before I'm willing to begin to think maybe there's some power that will move me. Maybe. And if I'm very fortunate, I'm given a thought, maybe I ought to take off my shirt and hook it to the old paddle I've been using and stick that up into the air and see if I can't hook into real power and get moving that way. Won't ever be my power. There's a world of difference between wanting to tap into power so I can use it to manage my life and being willing to tap into power that will manage my life. That's a big difference. What I really want is a line of credit on the power. And I'll write it down and use it my way. I'll make my little plan and then I'll begin to ask that it come out the way. And I'll take my little action and I'll begin to ask that it come out the way I want it to come out. And I can make a whole illusion of spiritual effort. Spiritual effort out of that. And I'll make my prayers and I'll think there's something for me to do. And on my best days, I'll say, oh, dear God, I don't know what you want me to do. I don't know if you want me to have an affair with the girl at the office or the one at the AA meeting, but I'm willing to go either way. Just guide me. And that's the top of my game, boy. That's it. That's my spiritual life. And I don't get that kind of a spiritual life because it's not a spiritual life. It's just self-will run riot. That's all in the world that it is. We have some problems. We're not going to spend any time talking about the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol. That reference is the what we call craving. As you know, the word craving refers to what happens to me once I take a drink. As an alcoholic, I'm going to set into cycle a terrible need for another drink and another drink and another drink. And we've all been down that road. And then a day came, astonishingly, when that cycle was broken up. Because we finally, in some way, begged for help. Happened to every one of us. And we don't get involved in that anymore because we don't take the first drink. The obsession that took us to the first drink doesn't take us to the first drink anymore because it's been removed. But the mind that harbored that obsession will take us all over the map. And on page 37 of this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, Wilson says, and he's talking about Jim, he had such knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all the reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Or I have the foolish idea that I can live this life if I only mix my AA program with my own judgment. Or I have the foolish idea that I can live a spiritual life if I'll only mix God's will with my will. Because we got to fine-tune it for our own particular case, don't we? Somehow. So I'm mixing it. He says, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? So I got a mind that really doesn't work well. It works well in one sense. It works well when I am involved in you. We have discovered that this business of sponsorship works very well. It works well for us, and it works well for the person we're sponsoring. We were talking at breakfast about some of the remarkable experiences that we've seen. When we reach out for someone, anybody else, God reaches out for both of us. It works. The only problem that I have is when I bring my mind around and bring it onto my own problems. Now I've got a difficult way to go. And I can't spot the difficulty in my own mind because the only tool I have to spot the difficulty is my mind. And so in that sense, we have the hound dogs watching the stakes. We've got a situation where, oh, my mind, no, if there was anything wrong with it, I'd know. Oh, wow. Really? And if you sense there's something wrong with my mind, guess what? You're way off base, pal. That can't be right. It doesn't end there, interestingly enough. It doesn't end there. We have an ego. There is a book called The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions. I just made a copy of a little piece of it where Dr. Tebow talks about the ego. He talks about the fact that there was in his day and still has been studies done that the mind of an alcoholic, and particularly the ego, is much different than the ego of other people. Here's how he says it. Despite most reports to the contrary, there is a growing recognition of certain common qualities regularly present in alcoholics. Characteristic of the so-called typical alcoholic is a narcissistic, egocentric core, dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent on maintaining at all costs its inner integrity. While these characteristics are found in other maladjustments, they appear in relatively pure culture in alcoholic after alcoholic. One researcher reported he felt he could discern the outlines of a common character structure among problem drinkers, and that the best terms he could find for the group of qualities noted was defiant individuality and grandiosity. In my opinion, he says, these words were accurately chosen. Inwardly, the alcoholic brooks no control from man or God. He, the alcoholic, is and must be the master of his destiny. He will fight to the end to preserve that position. I mean, I'll adopt a stupid position and defend it till the bitter end, is basically what he's saying here, because I got an ego that compels me to do that. In order for us to get sober, the book says that our ego has to be smashed. It revives itself and stays with us for the rest of our lives. But it can become a very good, trusted friend. It becomes a useful tool, but not because we allow it to run our lives. It doesn't do a good job at running our lives at all. It just is not designed to do that. And yet somehow we have allowed it to do that. There's another problem, and he describes this in the 12 and 12 in step 8. He says, and he's talking really about forgiveness and the blocks that there is. He says at step 8 in the 12 and 12 on page 79, though in some cases we cannot make restitution at all, and in some cases action ought to be deferred, we should nevertheless make an accurate and really exhaustive survey of our past life as it has affected other people. In many instances, we shall find that though the harm done others has not been great, the emotional harm we have done ourselves has. Very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging, emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they may have actually given our emotions violent twists which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. A few years ago, well, let me start someplace else. We can all go back in our memories. All go back in our memories to situations where we were just given violent twists. Events occurred that terrified us, and terror is not too strong a word. When our entire world as little children gets shattered, we are up against an abrupt surprise, and it doesn't need to be a huge deal to give us a little bit of a crazy thing. Wilson refers to the result of this as old ideas. A few years ago, I was, the phone rang on a Saturday in my house. Guy on the other line was Billy. Billy is a guy I knew in Orange County, and he had moved up to San Jose. And he'd worked up there for some years in the Silicon Valley doing computer stuff. He was very, very good at it. He really has a gift. And I love Billy, and he loves me, and we trust each other. And he was then 13 years sober, and I was, this was maybe 9 years ago, something like that. I said, get over here. And he came over to my house, and we sat and talked that afternoon in my home. And Billy was all excited because he had been offered a great new job by his employer. They were going to give him a car and a staff and send him out in the territory to solve computer problems in the factories and plants and facilities of the customers. whereas before he had worked in house in their in his own business, in his own employer's business. So it was a huge advance for him, a huge opportunity. And he was very excited about it. And I said, when do you start? He said, oh, I can't take it. I can't take the job. I said, no kidding. Why is that? He said, well, they want me to cut my hair. I said, Billy. Ever since I'd known him, he had hair that was down. It looked fine. There wasn't anything wrong with it, but it just was like down. I said, cut your hair. What's the difference? He said, no, they can't make me do that. I said, I used to think that meant a guy was hard of hearing and I'd start screaming at him, but I don't do that anymore. In my tolerance and wonderfulness. And I let it go, but I couldn't get it out of my mind, and we talked, and I said, Billy, come on now, what's with the hair? What's going on with that? He said, they can't make me. I said, stop that. Just stop it. He said, you know what it is? I can't get a haircut. I said, yeah, I know you can't, but why? He said, because I have badly deformed ears. My ears are bad. I said, no kidding. He said, yeah. I said, wow. It didn't feel right. I'd never heard about this before. Not that he should have told me, but I mean, you would have gotten a sense of it. He would have told somebody. And you know how it goes in AA. Once you tell somebody soon, there's 400 people that aren't going to repeat it, right? So we talked about something else and something else and something else, and I came back and said, Billy, let me see your ears. And he trusts me and he loves me, and he pulls his hair back like this. And what I saw was shocking, because his ears looked like my ears. And I went, whoa. I said, Billy, I got a newsflash for you, babe. Those ears aren't beauties, but they're not deformed. And he didn't believe that. I have a mirror hanging there in the den. We got up and we're kind of comparing ears in the mirror. And he looked and he looked, and we're looking at his ears and at my ears and all of that stuff. And finally he said, yeah, but they're so big. I said, they're not big. They're not any bigger than mine. I got a ruler, and we're standing there and comparing our ears with this ruler, measuring what's the. And he finally began to get it. That, and I said, where'd that idea come from? That's an old idea that your ears are bad. He said, I don't know. You know, any good alcoholic says, I don't know. I said, well, if you did know, what would the answer be? He goes, I don't know. So I took him on at a little different angle. I said, well, how does it make you feel? Oh, he knew the answer. He said, it makes me feel like a clown. I said, oh, well, I can see why you wouldn't want to get a haircut and go out in the territory. Because what do people do with clowns? He says, they laugh at them. I said, yeah. Okay. But what if it isn't true? What if it's an old idea and nothing more? Now, when did you first feel like a clown? When did you first feel that way? And he knew. He knew. He didn't even have to think about it. He said, third grade. I said, what happened? He said, well, I was 8 years old. I started when I was five, and I was 8 years old, and I'm running home from school one day. Good day, yeah. What'd you expect would happen when you got home? Oh, I thought my mom would give me a cookie and send me out to play and call me for dinner. I said, sounds like a good day. He said, yeah. I said, what was the upset? What happened? Because there's always a bump in the road. Everything's going along just fine, and then suddenly. He said, I went running in the back door, and my mom was in the kitchen on the phone talking to my aunt. I said, how do you know that? She said, he said she called her by name. Her name was Betty. She said, oh, my God, Betty, I got to hang up now. Billy just came running in, and we can't talk anymore because little pictures have big ears. And he never asked, what do you mean by that? He just drew his own conclusions. They'd kidded him, apparently, about his ears before. And he didn't know that that meant little kids hear everything and repeat it. He thought that was about his ears. And he saw something else. He saw his mother's face when he walked in, and she looked upset. And she was just gossiping on the phone and didn't want to be interrupted. But she was upset about that. And he felt that she was disappointed in him and his appearance and his ears and all of that kind of stuff. And he, as soon as he could grow his hair long to cover up those ears that offended his mother, he did that. He never, ever asked. He never asked. And the event itself was forgotten. He couldn't have told you anything that happened that day. All he knew was that for some reason or other, his ears were bad. At the time of these occurrences, they may actually have given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personalities. Very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of... And this is simply one that's a kind of a lightweight thing, except it was beginning to have impact in his life many, many, many years later. And by the time he got halfway through this story about his ears, he began to get it. He began to see that it was nothing but an old idea. And he was laughing and he was crying and we were both crying and laughing and carrying on and whooping and hollering around there. And he dropped that old idea that day that there was something wrong with his ears. And he, within a week, had gone out and gotten a haircut. Took him three haircuts, really, before he got the job done. He was sneaked up on it a little bit. And he went back up to the Silicon Valley and took that job they'd offered him, and he's been kicking ass up there ever since. And so that got me very interested in old ideas. That event made me see that these are really... Howard Polans, if you've met him, and I know some of you over at McKenzie have met him, talks about these limiting beliefs that we have. Baby elephant beliefs, he talks about. The idea that a baby elephant, if you tether it to a stake in the ground, he can't get away, he can't break that stake out of the ground. And even when he gets to weigh 2,000 pounds, tethering him to a stake will hold him right there because he knows he can't get away. He could whack it out of there in a heartbeat, but he knows he can't get away, and you can keep him there with a little stake in the ground. That's an old idea. It's a limiting belief. We have those. We have a lot of them. And they make it difficult for us to live in the world. So we have a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. We have... And the example I used last night was a silly example of somebody coming into my lane on the freeway and cutting me off. Because I know it's my lane. And I know that this person is out to get me. It can't just be somebody else driving into Los Angeles for a job. No, this is suddenly a crisis that is going to interfere with my career. In just that second, you know. And... so I have a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. And it gets us into a lot of trouble. And we have these old ideas. The way we have it wired up is not consistent with reality. When I was 4 years old, I was a happy kid. Basically, I was a happy kid. My dad was overseas. World War II was happening. My mom and I were the best of friends. And she would tuck me in at night And we would say our little prayers together, and we would laugh, and we would carry on. And we would whisper our secrets to one another, and I adored her, and she adored me, and we had a wonderful time. And one day, she was holding me and laughing with me, and she said, "What do you think of if I brought a little baby home from the hospital?" And I'm fine. Great. Okay, with knock yourself out. You know, that'll be good. My dad had come back on furlough some 8 or so months prior, and we had another baby coming in. And she did that. She brought this baby home from the hospital. And things changed around there because now her energy is going to this little baby. And they even had, you won't believe this, but they even had set up a room for this kid. Her own little room, yeah. A crib. And my mom was in there all the time. And she wasn't tucking me in much. And when she did, she didn't have any time for my stories and my stuff. And I didn't, I was having a real problem with that. And I knew the problem is the kid. And I'm just going to be so glad when they finally send that kid back. I had no idea they intended to keep that kid. And so when I began to get the idea that they were going to keep that kid, if I didn't do something about it, I began to go in there to that nursery and encourage my little sister to move out. I'd give her a little thump on the head. And of course, it didn't take my ma long to figure out that when I went in there, that kid started crying. And she followed me in there one day, and I don't know exactly what I was doing that day, but it scared my mom. And she picked me up and threw me out into the hall. And before I hit the wall and bounced down to the floor out in the hall, I knew that she didn't love me, that this was, that what had gone before was a horrible betrayal, just a joke. And I knew that she loved my sister and didn't love me. My mom went to war and I went to war. I couldn't, basically, it's about, I can't trust her. Can't trust him. If it was just limited to my mom, but it was my grandma too, can't trust her. And then it became limited, and then it became kind of, over time, it gets to be all the important women in my life, you can't trust them. Can't trust them. Can't trust women. We were in a very religious home, and it was the women in our home, my mom and my grandma, that brought us information about God. And so I developed another idea, and that is the only way I can get to God is through a woman. And then I developed, and then, you know, as the years went by, my mom didn't go anywhere. When I was still maybe 8 years old, I knew my mom didn't love me. But now I've got another big question to ask, because I've got some sense that what's going on is inconsistent with that notion. Well, if she doesn't love you, why doesn't she leave? Why is she still here? And I developed the idea that they stay because they have to. Women don't really love you, but they will hang around if they have to. You can imagine the problems that created later on in relationships. Terrible problems. Terrible. You can't trust them. I want to go to God, but I can't get there because I'm stuck with doing it through a woman that I can't trust. And the only reason they stick around is because they can't leave. And so the only woman I can bring in my life is one that can't leave. That's a terrible thing to have to deal with, because the women that I figured couldn't leave were either economically strapped or unattractive or, you know, an embarrassment, and I hated him for that. And it was just, the way this all was wired up was very weird, and I didn't even come close to unraveling this until I did a 4-column inventory. And I'm going into it now only because when I look at my mind, I've got some real problems with that mind. In terms of my personal, intimate relationships. in terms of evaluating what's going on with my life. And when Silkworth tells us that what's required is an entire psychic change, it isn't just with reference to our alcohol, our relationship with alcohol. It's with our relationship to the whole world around us. I need a new mind. And the mind I have, and the combination of old ideas, my ego, and this mind, means that I'm going to live an unmanageable life. Do you remember when you took your first cake and you saw people take their five-year cake, and you thought, man, that guy sounds a little lame to me. When I have 5 years, I'm going to really be handled, right? And then you get 5 years and you go, you know, when I get to have 10 years, I'm going to be in better shape than that guy. But we don't seem to make the progress we were certain that we would make in sobriety. Because while the obsession is removed, and we don't need to deal with the craving anymore, the same mind that took us to booze took us to conclusions and decisions that were just boggle anybody else's mind. Just, wow, how could you think that was a good idea? You haven't had a drink in 18 months and you still think that was great. And we're just working off of these old ideas. And so we need a new mind. And that's the essence of it. If you take a look, for example, at these examples in More About Alcoholism, on chapter 3, he's really saying, basically, More About Alcoholism is his way of telling us, look at the mind that took you to that drink. Look at Jim. Is he a trophy? And we read that story about Jim, and the first 25 times I read it, I went, oh, yeah, that sounds right. Jim had a charming wife and family. Jim was a bright guy, a good World War record. He was good with people, great personality. Drank too much. He drank way too much. And he kept getting fished out of these asylums. He lost his ownership of a car dealership through his drinking, but he stayed on working for the car dealership. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? And then they asked him to tell them about how he started drinking again. And he said, well, I got to work on a Tuesday morning. And if you've heard Joe and Charlie, you know the question right there is, what happened to Monday, Jim? It's a good question. He said, I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Jim, words with the boss are always serious. But we minimize that. I was mildly irritated because I had to work for a agency I used to own. I'll bet you were mildly irritated, Jim. You had to be livid. You're sliding in there on a Tuesday morning with a bad hangover from God knows what happened over the weekend and on Monday, and you had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Right. And then he's just getting warmed up now, because he says, I decided to take a drive out in the country where I might find a prospect for a new car. That's where they are, Jim, lying in those country roads, man, waiting for you. I mean, in the first 200 times I read that, I'm going, yeah, okay, I understand that. You know, got it. Yeah, hey, seems right to me. Woo! Decided to stop at a roadhouse. I'd been there before. See, it's familiar. We find out in a sentence or two, it also has a bar. But he's going to have lunch. He's hungry. Remember how hungry he used to get on Tuesday after being drunk for 3 days? Hardly stand the thought of food. But he's going in there because there might be a customer for a car in there. They just wait for you there, Jim. They're going to turn in their app. We all need an app. So he goes in there, I'm filling in the blanks here now because I've thought about Jim a lot. I get Jim. I'm thinking, I'm in there and I order a sandwich and a glass of milk. And I got this vague notion that maybe, see, tonight I got to go home. It's Tuesday night now and I got to go home and the wife and the kids are there. And I'm going to get some questions from her. One of them is going to be, how'd your day go? Did you get anything to eat, honey? And I want to be able to proudly announce that I had a sandwich and a glass of milk. In fact, bring me another sandwich and another glass of milk. He ordered another sandwich and another glass of milk. I'm really kind of on a, it's almost like being on a health kick, you know? All is well. You might get back into the big bed on the strength of two glasses of milk during the day and a couple of sandwiches. And that kind of fills you with a sort of wonderful sense of recovery that it occurs to you that, hey, now that I'm back in the big bed and my wife's okay with me, bring me a shot. I'll pour it into that milk. I mean, her mind just takes it. I've decided she's going to buy the milk and sandwich story. We're all going to be happy. And now I'm celebrating because I'm back in the big bed. I haven't even gone home yet. And that experiment worked so well, he did it again. And we look at that story and we go, yeah, sounds right to me. I don't get the insanity of that. I don't get the insanity of a jaywalker skipping in front of a fast-moving trolley. Skipping. I like that word, skipping. I don't get the insanity of a guy that's worked for all his life and he quit drinking 25 years earlier, but now that he's not working, he can drink again. And he's dead in no time. I don't get the insanity of a guy that's accountant, a partner in an accounting firm. I mean, this is a powerful guy. This is a guy that goes to Washington during the war and serves on boards. This is a well-connected, very bright, good with people, happy family, accountant. This guy has depth. One little problem. He's afflicted with a disease called alcoholism, and he's been to AA, and he knows all about it now. And he's going to be okay. More about alcoholism. And he gets drunk. And drunk and drunk. The insanity is the mind that we bring to it. And there's something else that's wonderful about this. Because if you change the word a little bit, listen to this. Despite all we can say, there are many who are real alcoholics and they're not going to believe they're in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his thinking or control his living, the drinking is gone, can do the right about face and live like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to live like other people. To think like other people. So we limit the number of things. Paul did that funny thing about limiting the number of thinks. Or do you crave a think at a given time a day? Have you ever lost a job due to your thinking? These are important questions. And then they took me back through this thing and said, you know, there's some things in here that we always assumed would work and we want you to circle those things and let's just check and see if they kept Jim sober. He had a charming wife and family. Didn't work. He had a lucrative automobile. Didn't work. Commendable World War. Didn't work. He was a good set. Didn't work. He's liked. He's intelligent. Doesn't work. When you distill all that down, here's some of the things that Fred had. Fine home. Didn't work. Happily married. Happily married. It didn't work. Father of promising children. Much ashamed of getting drunk. Shame doesn't work. Made up his mind to quit drinking. Firm resolve does not work. He had character and he had standing. He conceded that he had some problem. None of that works. He had a humiliating experience. It doesn't work. He had splendid judgment, determination. Doesn't work. I was much impressed with what you told me. Being much impressed with what AA has to say doesn't work. Appreciated your ideas. Fred, nobody cares if you appreciate our ideas. It won't work. It won't help you. Reason, self-confidence, willpower, keeping on guard, always well, no pressing problems, end of a perfect day, none of that works. It distills down to this. More about alcoholism, about my mind, the mind that takes me to a weird kind of a life. None of this works to solve those problems. Luck, success, work, firm resolve, casual thinking, self-knowledge, mixing it, having a family, high IQ, discipline, hospitalization, being careful, humiliating experiences, going to the asylums, or shame. None of that works. And yet we have that if we have a good enough life or are punished enough, that somehow or other, all of that is going to work. If I can only get this job, my life will be okay, meaning that it will become manageable. I'll tell you the truth. Here's the truth. If I win the lottery, my life will become manageable. Does that sound great? All I ever wanted to do was make enough money so I didn't have to trust God. Is that too much to ask? We are delusioned, you know. We really have some strange stuff going on in our mind. I was looking up words in the dictionary as I was going through this. Did you do that? This high? They're wonderful. They're just wonderful. Do you know what willing means? Gladly ready. I thought it meant gun to the head time, boy. Somebody called me the other day. They said, I just looked up the word recovery. See, I knew what all these words meant, so I didn't look them up. Recovery. You know what one definition of recovery is? The extraction of something valuable out of that which appears to have no value. Recovery. Nice definition of it. Nice definition. The extraction of something precious out of that which appears to have no value. We have a big problem then, and it's just all in step one. And the reason that I'm spending a little time on it in terms of our thinking is that until I own the problem, I'm never going to buy the solution. Not really. I cannot sign on for the solution until I have the problem, till I own the problem. And the problem is I've got a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. I'm sober now. The obsession to drink has been removed. And I've got a problem. I've got a horrible problem. And the problem is my life isn't working and I can't make it work. And I'm in the middle of AA and I'm involved in unity and I'm involved in service. And I'm going to meetings and I'm doing the deal and I'm sponsoring other guys and I'm whatever they ask me to do, I do that. Because I have the illusion that since I'm sober and since I only get a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, I think I'm living a spiritual life because I am sober, but the sobriety doesn't have anything to do with me. God removed that obsession to drink. And I'm just as powerless now to drink as I was powerless not to drink when I got here. And it escapes me, really escapes me, that I don't have any way to live a kind of life that'll bring me joy and happiness. Because of all of this stuff I've been talking about all morning. And it's kind of, that's why I don't like to talk about it Friday night. Everybody goes to bed in a suicidal daze. You know, Jesus. Wow. But you're tough now. You've had breakfast and a night's sleep and you can take it. One more thing and then we'll take a break. One of the key questions they asked me was, because I'm glib and I'm slick and I'm 23 years sober and I'm AA slick is what I am. You know what I mean? I got the vocabulary and I got all that going on. The only thing I had going for me was that I completely failed in every department of my life at 23 years of sobriety. That's the only thing I had going for me that gave me even a glimpse of an open mind. And so the question was, did I fit into any of these categories, like Jim and Fred, with this craziness? And I'm not sure about that. And they said, what were the craziest things you ever did? Write down the 20 craziest things you ever did. And I went back to him with my list of crazy things that I did. And we will take a break, and when we come back, we'll be sliding into step two, and I'll talk to you about the 20 craziest things I ever did and the point of the whole question. So let's take 10 and come back at 10 o'clock. All right, shall we get going? We're just taking a quick look at step one because it is so important that we get that there is a problem going on with her mind. And I'll just give you another take on it. When I went back to that guy with those crazy things that I had done, I had a pretty, what I thought was an interesting list, and I'm sure you do too. The first time I got arrested was off of the fire escape of the Tri-Delta House at the University of Oregon in Eugene. I had been at an off-campus tavern earlier that evening, and one of the gals that lived in the Tridale House almost looked at me, and so I felt we had something going. And at midnight, I was heading up there to talk to her about our future. And they arrested me. Now, that seemed kind of crazy to me. I got a couple of years later, I was a student at the dental school in Portland, where I should not have been. It was not a good move for me to go up there. And that was insane in itself. And I did it because my dad asked me one time when I was in high school what I was going to do with my life. And I said, well, I think I'll be a dentist. And he didn't hit me, so I kind of made a career decision about that. And now I'm up at the dental school, but I'm a drunk, and I've also stumbled into something called Dexamil. And you wake up on Saturday morning after getting drunk on Friday night, and you drop 2 15-milligram spanduls of Dexamil, and it wakes you up. And you can, but it also gives you a fine tremor. And I had a guy in the chair at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning in the clinic at the dental school, and they just come out with that new high-speed air-driven handpiece, and you could take out a quadrant of teeth just twitching. I got a guy down here. Open your mouth, open wide. I made a set of dentures for a guy the first year I was up there, and he came back the second year, and he'd see me. He brought his wife up, and somebody was doing something for her, and he'd see me, and he'd go, say. Something wrong with my teeth, he'd say. Insane of me to be up there. Insane. I hated it. I just hated every bit of it in the clinic. I didn't mind some of the other stuff, but the clinic where I had, and my, you know, I was humiliated by how my hands would tremble and shake, and this stuff would just be clattering around you, dropping things on the floor. And they don't like to hear you say whoops when you're working around. You know, so I told him about that and about getting kicked out and about drinking in a Skid Row in those days on Burnside Street in Portland. Maybe still, I don't know. But in those days, it was like those bars were just something. I like Skid Row drinking because they don't ask you any weird questions like, how are you? You know, they just set them up. I came out of a blackout sitting across a table, a little wooden table that was all carved up. I'm across from a woman. I don't know who she was. I have no idea her name. Never did figure it out. It felt like we were together, though. You know what I'm saying? She, and on the road, because she had her things with her in paper bags there. I didn't know the nature of our relationship, anything about her. I didn't know, and I would have asked her, but she was sleeping, and I didn't want to wake her up. I wrote all that down. Crazy stuff. She had a little chili on her cheek, so I knew we'd had dinner, and that was about all I knew. Some delicate flower I'd invited to dine that night. And there's a line in the book in the back stories. One of the personal stories, this guy says this one line. I looked at it and it just kind of leaped out at me because it sort of typifies my life. It said, "Somehow I got out of there," and I'm thinking, yeah. Whether it was a fight or a bar or a Marine Corps or the jail or a marriage or somehow I got out of there. I never saw her again. I wrote that down. I wrote down about going in the Marine Corps after that, about my commander that said there isn't any room in the Marine Corps for an alcoholic lieutenant, and how shocked I was that he said that to me. How I knew he was wrong, how I knew his judgment was bad, and how I knew I needed a drink more than I needed anything else that morning. And how they offered me a chance to resign my commission for the good of the service and to avoid a court-martial. And how I finally got out of there, and I was so, because I loved the Marine Corps, I loved it. I really, really, more than life, I wanted to be a good Marine officer. Couldn't pack the gear, and it was so humiliating. And I moved to Glendale, California. After I got out, I lived in an apartment for a while and then in the car and then in the shed. But while I was driving the car, my last arrest for drunk driving was at 10 on a Saturday morning when the beer wasn't working. I was heading out to get a drink and the light was red, so I stopped and the light turned green and amber and red and green and amber. I was sleeping. Gathering myself for the, you know, into the steering. The guy right behind me was in a cop car, and he came up, tapped on the window. "Sir, that's the only shade of green we have here in Glendale. You'll have to..." They get so cute. Yanks me out of that car. He starts to give me this, like, touch your nose thing, and then he just said, "You're under arrest." When I saw the police report 3 weeks later, he had written down, "I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself." And I thought, well, yeah, yeah. There's a life with power in it, isn't it? So I go back to this guy with my list, and he reads this list over, and I had some other stuff too, and he said, "This is crazy, a lot of alcohol in here." I said, "Yeah." He said, "But you didn't write down the craziest thing you ever did." I said, "What is that?" And he said, "You did it repeatedly." "Yeah, what are you talking about?" And he said, "You did it before you started to drink. Every time you did it before you had alcohol in your system." I said, "What?" He said, "It was really crazy." I said, "What?" He said, "You decided to drink. Dry brain, no booze, all this history of bad experiences with alcohol, and the best you can come up with that fine mind of yours, is that you need a drink, and you decide to drink again." He said, "That's insane, and you brought that mind into AA, and you better get that." And I got it. I really got that. I got why my life is unmanageable. And it sketches out like this. That Roman numeral one is for step one. There's a powerlessness, and this is over booze and over no booze. I'm bodily powerless, and I'm mentally powerless. And the mental powerlessness has to do with my mind, it has to do with old ideas, and it has to do with my ego. All of this taken together means that I have an unmanageable life. My life is unmanageable because I am powerless in these ways, and I cannot manage that. I cannot manage that life because the tool that I would ordinarily use to manage the life when turned on my own assessment of my own problems, always tells me that the problem is out there. And if the problem is out there, I don't have an answer. And I'm just going to repeat and repeat and repeat, and I'm going to see life through my old ideas and my perceptions, and I'm going to call that reality. And I'm in a lot of trouble as a human being, and I don't care how long I'm sober, I'm in a lot of trouble as a human being because I think the problem is out there. And it isn't out there, it's right here. And this unmanageability can be reduced to another phrase, spiritual deficit. The unmanageability is itself a spiritual deficit because all I've got is myself to do all of this stuff, and I'm convinced that I can do it. And it really leads you to terrible, terrible problems. And you can see why. With all the crazy old ideas I have, I can't have a marriage. And yet I got one more thing going for me. And we were talking about it at the break. I have a deep need to feel alive. Somebody told me that people that are, I think it's either bulimia or anorexic, where they binge and purge. I don't know the name of it, but they get addicted to the brain chemistry created by vomiting. They're alive when they're setting that up. Or a gambler. He's addicted to the brain chemistry produced in some way, a very interesting way. It's not when he wins and it's not when he loses, but when he's got everything on the line. That's his moment. That's when he's alive. We were fully alive for a brief 10-second period at some point during our drinking or drugging. And now we're sober and we still need to feel alive. And whatever the deal is, we'll do it. I was in sobriety, sober many years, working in Santa Ana in an office. I was married and living in San Clemente, which is about 35 miles south. And I had a girlfriend in Los Angeles who was a sitting judge. And I would go up and see her. And then I would drive to my office and do some work for a while, so I could say I'd been working. And then I would go home. And it was on the 35-mile drive down to San Clemente that I would begin to know, tonight's the night she's going to present me with the evidence that I have been cheating. And I would spend my whole drive down there imagining that. And I felt more alive at that time than any other time. That was more aliveness to me than the earlier part of the evening in bed with somebody I shouldn't have been in bed with. And that was very interesting stuff. But it didn't bring me the aliveness. I have a friend that was a few years ago, and this guy's got 27 years of sobriety now, and he's still tapping his way to the curb in a lot of ways. And I love him like a rainbow, and he loves me. And, there's just such a... It's like we need to wake up to what really is going on. A few years ago, this guy decided he was in danger of having a heart attack. And he read all this information about it, and he knew the symptoms, he knew the blood chemistry attached to that, he knew it all. And he'd wake his wife up in the middle of the night and say, take me to the hospital, I'm having a heart attack. His business was going into the toilet, and he would, but he needed something, And she had already been married and lost a husband to another disease, and so she was afraid to say, no, go back to sleep. And she loves him, and she believes him, and if he said he's having a heart attack, she's getting up, and she's putting on her clothes, and she drives him down to the hospital in Pasadena. And they check him out and send him home. And he did that 2 or 3 times a week. And he never felt more alive than when he was on his way to the hospital at midnight thinking he was going to die. We need to be alive. And we do crazy things to get to feel that we're alive. They're not necessarily pleasant things, but they give us a sense of aliveness. And that seems to be so important to us. And there is a spiritual deficit that's attached to that. Because until I have a relationship going with my higher power, I don't have another good way to feel alive. except when I'm involved in service, it gives me some relief. When I'm involved in unity, it gives me some relief. Thank God there's some relief from that state. Thank God I've got a place to go that I can get some relief. But when we get involved in recovery, we don't get relief, we get freedom. And there's a big difference between freedom and relief. And there's a great sense of aliveness that comes out of that. But that's the problem. That's the problem. I'm powerless. I don't have any power. And I really must own the problem before I'll sign on for the solution. And it took me a long way because everything I did was designed to make me feel like I had some power. And when that was all stripped away in 100 days, I really was so frightened. And when this, a year later, this answer came along, I didn't have any choice. I had no choice. I did not do it out of virtue. And I'm not up here out of virtue. I'm just like, here's what happened. And I want to make it clear, too, that my experience in going through the steps is what I'm reporting to you. I'm not reporting to you how you ought to do it at all. I don't want you to think I'm telling you what you should do. I don't think there's a wrong way to take these steps except for us to do it our way. If we can bend ourselves to the discipline of doing it somebody else's way, especially the way that's set out in the book, we're going to get the best results. Whether you do it the way I did it or not, all I can tell you is this is what I did, this is the result I got. And that's all I'm going to tell you. So that's step one.